would be a distribution of signal densities between a low signal density and a higher signal density experiment. We also wanted to simulate different library depths to see what that effect would have on the ability to call differentially accessible regions. We used up to 20 replicates per condition, although no real attack-seek experiment does this, so that we could later downsample to anywhere from 2 to 5 to 10, all the way up to 20 replicates. And we also looked at the difference in signal density by condition and what having a tighter or more messy, we would call it, signal distribution look like. So you could think of this as maybe doing a cell line experiment versus doing an in vivo experiment where there's a lot more variability within replicants. So from our simulated data, we looked at six different statistical methods traditionally used for calling DEGs and now calling DARs, differentially accessible regions. So we looked at either a simple Wilcoxon test, a t-test, and then four widely used R packages, EDGE-R, LEMA, DEEC, and DEEC2. And what this panel shows here is, using three replicates, what the ability to capture true positives looks like. So when we simulated our data, we simulated some of the signals with having a 10% signal difference between a low and a high condition, a 20%, a 50%, and a 100% difference in average signal density. And from this data, we can see that LEMA and EDGE-R consistently have the highest sensitivity among all of the methods evaluated. So as the signal density difference between the two conditions increases, it makes sense that we can call more DARs, we find more of the true positives, and we see that LEMA and EDGE-R have the highest number of true positives being identified with this method. And especially if we want to look at very low signal density, so down at 1 CPM, LEMA has a significantly better performance in terms of calling true positives. Of course, on the flip side of that, we want to look at what the false positive rate is when we perform this analysis. And looking at the 1 CPM, 5 CPM, and 10 CPM data, we see that while LEMA and EDGE-R have the highest sensitivity, they also have a higher false positive rate. Although all of the analysis methods being looked at here have a false positive rate less than 5%, which is what the FDR was set at for these experiments. But we see that among the methods that were evaluated here, DEEC2 and DEEC have a lower false positive rate. The Wilcoxon test has a zero false positive rate because looking at three replicates, it was unable to identify any true positives as well. It effectively lacks the statistical power to differentiate between the conditions. So kind of a way to merge your sensitivity and your specificity is through the use of ROC curves, and we show how these methods look using the ROC curve method. So we can see both now specificity and selectivity at the same time, and we see that all the methods actually perform fairly well. This is now looking at just at peaks or signals that have a 50% signal density difference and our control signals to get us an idea of specificity. So while the area under the curves, which is the traditional way of looking at an ROC plot, shows that all these methods perform fairly well, you might notice that there are small filled circles on each of these plots, and these show what the specificity and sensitivity of each of these methods are at an FDR of 0.05. And looking at this, we can see where LEMA and EDGE-R, again, have a much higher, at least a significantly higher sensitivity than DEEC or DEEC2. And then the simple statistical methods of the Wilcoxon and T-test are performing far below the four commonly used R packages. So as I mentioned, we simulated up to 20 replicates in our simulated data so that we could see what the effect of using a higher number of replicates are in recall. And as we show here on the x-axis, as we increase the number of replicates, we have a higher ability to recall true positives. And each of the different curves are a different type of peak that's being looked at. So ranging anywhere from 1 CPM to 20% signal difference between a high and low signal density experiment, and up to 10%, or I'm sorry, 10 CPM with a 50% mean difference. And as would be expected, we have an increase in the number of true positives that can be called as we increase the replicates we use, with notable exception for DE-Seq2 using very low CPM true positives. And this might be because of DE-Seq2's model for calling, calling DEGs, or now in our examples, DARs. But if we look at where the biggest gain in number of true positives are, we see that it's going from 2 to 3 replicates being used. So in providing a, guidance for what conditions to use, we would recommend that experimenters use at least 3 replicates to achieve a reasonably high sensitivity. While the sensitivity does increase with the number of replicates, after 3 replicates, especially for Lima or EdgeR, the increase is not nearly as high. We also looked at the effects of library size on recall. So when we simulated our peaks table, while the peaks all had the same distribution of CPMs, they could have a different number of counts for each peak if the overall library size was larger. And this is important because most tools like EdgeR, DE-Seq, DE-Seq2 look at counts data instead of normalized data to CPM. Lima, on the other hand, uses already normalized data. So what we can see from this data is that as we go from an effective library size, so this would be how many reads we identify under peaks in an attack-seq experiment, from 10 million to 20 million reads under a peak, or under all the peaks, we see that there's a significant increase in the performance of all of the methods being used. Whereas when we go from 20 million up to 30 million effective reads, there continues to be some increase in performance, but the increase in performance is much smaller. So from this data, we recommend to users to try to achieve a library size such that you would get at least 20 million reads under peaks. So the higher the library sequencing depth is, the more successful any of these methods are in calling DARs. So we moved on then from looking at our simulated data into applying what we've seen here to real data. And so this looks at some liver and kidney samples from mouse data. These are real liver versus kidney samples. And as we can see, there's a strong separation between the two different conditions. And when using all 6 replicates in this particular study, we see that all 3 methods being looked at, how DE-Seq, 2, EdgeR, and Lima, show a very strong concordance of peaks. So all 3 methods are in strong agreement with each other. However, what we noticed is that when we begin downsampling, so this would be instead of using all 6 replicates, using only 5 replicates for each condition, or 4, 3, or 2, we see that there's a drastic drop in the recall rate of DE-Seq2 and to a somewhat lesser degree Lima compared to EdgeR. So while DE-Seq2 and Lima are less able to identify the same DARs that were identified when using all 6 replicates, EdgeR performs much better in still being able to identify these DARs. Even down to 2 replicates, EdgeR can identify over 75% of the original DARs. Also worth noting is this new DARs category, which we treated as being potential false positives arising from having a small number of replicates. And matching what we saw in our simulated data, DEC2 best controlled these possible false positives, while again matching the simulated data, EDGE-R had the highest sensitivity group. So in looking to make an appropriate DAR cutoffs from this data, we looked at several different conditions that we could use for making DAR cutoffs. So when we consider this, we look at what FDR we choose and also what signal density differences required between two conditions. And in performing this, we noted that while using an absolute signal difference of 50%, you can retain most of the DARs that are originally seen. And using an FDR of 0.01, of course, reduces the number of DARs you see over 0.01. And on the right panel, we see the comparison of our ATAC-seq data, real data for liver versus kidney, to matched RNA-seq, liver versus kidney gene expression for genes, or I should say for DARs in promoter regions. And what we can see is that if we require in light blue a absolute signal difference of at least 100% and an FDR less than 0.01 or 0.001, we see a 0.01, we see a very high correlation between the ATAC signal difference and the RNA-seq gene expression levels. When we lower our cutoff down to a 50% signal difference, we retain a relatively strong correlation and a very similar slope between the two. And if we go any lower, so now down to requiring an FDR of only 0.01 and that 50% signal difference, our R value continues to drop and our slope of the line looks a lot different from our what would be assumed to be our highest quality peaks at the 100% difference in an FDR of at least 0.01. So based on this, our recommendation is that using an FDR of less than 0.01 and a signal density of 50% difference between a high signal density and low signal density condition would be expected to yield a reliable set of DARs while keeping a high measure of sensitivity. So this is all well and fine, but often we have experiments that have relatively poor separation between experimental conditions. We show here an experiment that we performed in this group to consider two regions of the hippocampus, the dentate gyrus and Ammon's horn. And these are from in vivo samples. And as we see on the left side here, there is no separation among the samples in the PCA plot that shows the samples for the two different conditions. However, if we use the package RUV-seq to perform batch effect correction, we can see that there's now a strong separation between the two conditions. This is using K equal to 3. And we've also looked at using EDGE-R DEC2's batch effect correction by using batches in the experimental design, and they do not perform nearly as well as using RUV-seq. So to briefly apply what we've learned, this shows that same hippocampus attack experiment. And on the left, we see the volcano plot with no batch effect correction. On the right, we see the volcano plot using the batch effect correction plus the conditions we recommend in EDGE-R. So that's a 0.001, so 10 to the negative 3. FDR and a full change of at least 50% signal difference. And we can see that this yields a large number of DARs, and we expect these, or at least hope these DARs, to be reliable. and we can gain insight to whether these DARs are indeed reliable by looking at what go terms are associated with these DARs. So for the yellow, we see go terms for the Ammon's horn, which is a more terminally differentiated set of neuronal cells. And we see terms, go terms, that are a lot more, that are quite relevant to what these should look like. So for example, axon achievement, myelation, and various negative regulations of cell processes. The dentate gyrus is a little more difficult to interpret. We'll talk about that in one moment. Earlier, I've given a presentation about visualizing batch effect corrected samples on a browser. So I'm not going to go too in-depth of how we set up the code for doing that, other than to say that after performing batch effect correction, often the bed graph files that you see for the raw data do not seem to match what the statistical analysis says using EdgeR on the batch effect corrected data. So we developed a package which we call bcorrect, bed graph corrector, to remedy this, to show data now that looks appropriate for batch effect corrected bed graph files. And what we see in these examples here is that in the uncorrected samples, there is a much higher level of variability among the replicates, whereas in the corrected samples, replicates show a much smaller amount of variability, explaining why they're now called as being DARs in the statistical analysis. One final example that we'll use from this is SNAP25, a gene that is known to be dentate gyrus specific over Ammon's horn. If and this is indeed called in our DAR analysis for the hippocampus data. However, if we were to look at this data using the before correction bed graphs, it would be the top two sets of peaks. That might cast a little bit of doubt on whether or not these samples are truly showing differential accessibility. However, after batch effect correction for the bed graphs using bcorrect, we see a much more clear difference between the two different conditions, with the dentate gyrus showing a high signal in its promoter in comparison to the Ammon's horn data. So our conclusions from our work on giving recommendations for differential analysis, differential accessibility analysis in ATAC-seq, is we would recommend using at least three replicates and having sufficient depth in the libraries to achieve about 20 million reads under peaks. For users wanting to achieve a high sensitivity, we recommend using EdgeR or Lima for attacking, or if you're attempting to detect very low signal density peaks. If your goal is to detect a smaller set of peaks, but a set of peaks that is extremely selective for true positives, we'd recommend DEC2. We recommend using an FDR of 0.001 and a single density difference of around 50%, excuse me, to achieve high sensitivity with reliable DAR calls. Of course, we recommend using PCA on all to make sure the data looks good, and to use RUV-seq to correct for batch effects. And finally, if you want to visualize batch effect corrected data, we recommend using our package bcorrect to do that. Any questions? Sorry, I went a couple minutes over there. Bless you.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Sorry. So I have a question about the bcorrect.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, for the ATAC-seq, after running the RUV, it's usually sort of like a corrected for a subset of the peaks. So what do you do for the ones that were not included in the RUV process?
Right. So for bcorrect, and I haven't shown the methods for how we do this again, we'll use several different methods to adjust the bed graph signal for peaks depending on what the signal looks like in the raw and the corrected counts table. So for peaks that have counts in both the raw and corrected table, we'll scale by the value that we see from the raw to the corrected counts table. For peaks that are either don't have a corrected value or peaks that are between two called peaks, so signals between two called peaks, we'll use the a weighted mean between the correction factors for the nearest two called peaks on either side of the region that we're considering. So in the case of a peak that gets filtered out using RUV, it would be scaled by a weighted mean of the two peaks nearest to it. And the weighted mean would be based on how close the region or the peak that we're looking at is to either one of those peaks that are around it.
I see, thanks.
Can you back up and explain what samples are in each batch?
We're looking here or further?
I guess I don't understand how many and what the identity of each batch is.
So here we have, these are four samples that came from the dentate gyrus and four samples that came from Ammon's horn. These are in vivo samples. So for using RUV-seq, we call the batch for one the dentate gyrus, the batch for the other to be the Ammon's horn samples. And RUV-seq will then remove unwanted variants between the two of them to leave hopefully only the true biological signal difference between the two.
So you're treating the two different tissues as two different batches, is what I'm hearing. Is that accurate? Or are you saying that these are paired samples and there are four batches?
This should be using the two different signals, tissues as batches.
So tell me how the batch effect is, it seems to me it's completely confounded by the differences between the two tissues. I guess that's what I don't quite understand.
Correct. So if using RUV-seq, if using DE-seq too, yeah, the batch effect would be confounded by the paired samples, I believe. But RUV-seq uses a different methodology. It uses an upper quantile normalization based on EDGE-R, and then removes however many sources of variation you want to ascribe to being from batch effect. So we chose here K equals 3. The user actually has to input what the K is for this.
And K is symbolizing what?
The number of factors of variation being removed. So number of factors of variation being removed don't correspond exactly to any one particular effect. So you could say, for example, effect one is sex, for example. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Maybe that's the idea behind it, is that you're removing unwanted sources of variation.
Okay, I guess I just have to read up on RUV-seq. It seems to me like you might be throwing away some wanted variation as well. But I'll study up on those.
Right, there's always a concern when you perform batch correct affection that you are losing either real signal difference or that you're introducing artifacts into the data. So if you have a data, for example, like the first one that I showed, there's a very clear separation between the two, you may not want to perform any batch effect correction there. You're not trying to squeeze out a few extra DARs from that at the risk of introducing new artifacts into the data. But if you have a sample like this where there's no separation between samples and you can't, then introducing the possibility of artifacts into the data seems to be well worth it, that you can now get usable data out of these samples.
Thanks, Paul.
So I have a different, this is Christian from Baylor. I have a different question. So one issue we've seen when looking at ChIP-seq replicates and using fewer and fewer is that sometimes not all the certain regions are not covered in certain samples, okay? Just, I mean, as a technical, you know, artifact, you don't have enough coverage, you know, you don't pick some regions. Your simulation, I mean, does it account for difference in just purely difference in, you know, covered regions between the samples? Or this assumes that the ATAC-C covers pretty well the whole genome or the whole regions?
Right. This does assume that the ATAC-C covers the whole genome. Usually the strategy that we use for real ATAC-C data would be to take the replicates and the peaks called from all the replicates and merge them all together. So as long as the peak is being called in one replicate, it will be used in the peak set that we use for differential accessibility analysis. And what will happen is we'll look at all the different peaks that we see across all the different replicates and the different experimental conditions, merge those together, and then call counts under each of those. So if one sample, for example, didn't have a high enough number of counts to call a peak on its own, that in theory won't be an issue as long as one of the samples had a high enough number of counts to call a peak there, because we'll look at all the different peaks from all the different samples and count on the statistical model to detect what's actually different between the two, whether a peak is called in every single replicate or not.
So in your strategy for downsampling, maybe I missed that part. When you downsample the, or you have your replicates, you have done, you know, some, you know, extensive subsampling. So if you sample 3 out of 6, you know, you don't sample just once, 3 once. You sample, so you sample, you know, 3 different samples every single time, and then you present an average over those 3 replicates.
I believe that is what's been done. Yes, I think Bo might have a clarification on that. But I believe, or Ben Peng might, but I believe that's what we did. We looked at the different different pairs of samples being used and didn't just perform one comparison among the 3.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Paul. And so any questions? And if there's no further questions, we keep moving on. Wenqing and Benpeng, do you have any like the update you want to talk today?
Hi, Bo. So I tried some like a TE centered analysis, but it's like very preliminary. I can share my screen for that.
Sure. Thank you so much. That's
yeah. Cool. And also, yeah, I would like input on that because I sort of like get stuck a little bit. Okay. Could you see my screen?
Yes.
Yeah. So the thing we were trying to do is like to see whether we can use the data we already generated, the target RNA-seq data, and try some expression analysis, focusing on the transposable element. So the first thing I tested is like, since we already have the data processed, that is like, could we use the already processed data for our analysis? And the short answer is maybe not, because for the default parameters we used for the RNA-seq alignment, and here are the 2 sort of like most relevant to us for this set of analysis. The first one is basically filtering out the read that mapped to multiple places, which would be sort of like repetitive regions, and that would include the transposable element. And the default value for that is 10, and that's what we used. This is a slightly like a small, especially considering some of the suggestions that were out there by the known publications. Sometimes people would recommend increasing this number to like a few hundred to get a large number, to get a relatively large number of grid that map to multiple locations. And the second parameter that is relevant to us is the outsum attribute. So we use the default value, which means it only contains certain set of the tags that would be included in this in the BAM file. And the thing is, if we want to do the transcript assembly, which can be very beneficial for us to dissect either like a transcript originated from the transposable element or maybe like alternative, like a splicing event. And for that to happen, usually we run the string tie 2 or string tie, and that does require the XS tag in the SAM file. And without it, basically you won't be able to assemble the like the introns. For example, here is just like an example. So on the top here, this is a GTF file from the gene annotation. And this would be like this is actually a random place in the genome on the X chromosome. And here, this track with the sort of like gray color, this is the assembled result using our current output. So basically without the XS tag, what we can see is it detects some of these axons, but we are missing the intron part, which means we will need to, if we want to do that, we will need to reprocess like the RNA-seq data to include this. So I checked online, it seems like it will be complicated to add this tag in, but rather it will be easy to just reprocess things. And this actually leads to the second question I was considering while thinking through that, is shall we do the two-pass alignment to increase the splicing junction detection? So to look into this, I did some like a really simple analysis. The first thing is I took the splice junction output from the star and did some like a simple selection to check how many new junctions are we obtaining using the current alignment method. And the way I filtered the file is I excluded all the non-canonical junctions and also like I only include junctions that are supported by uniquely by at least three uniquely aligned read, and select the ones that are not annotated, meaning they are not present in the GTF file. And if we simply check the number of so-called the new junctions we obtained for the 5 months liver samples, we see for all the samples on average, we get around like about 3,000 to around maybe 7,000 new junction instances. And this is plotting the number of new junctions per sample. And if we do a percentage test, basically using the number of new junctions divided by the total junctions we are obtaining per sample, we are getting about like 2 to 5% of new junctions. So this leads to the question, would it worth it to like basically insert those new junctions back to the genome index and do like a sort of like the two-pass alignment? And I tried it a little bit. And the way I did it is like based on what they call the classical two-pass alignment strategy. So instead of doing it on the fly per sample, what I tried is I collected all the new junctions from all the 5 months RNA-seq samples, and that leads to a total of like 300-something thousand new junctions across all the 5 months T2C samples. And I reviewed the star index by splicing those new junctions into the parameter. That we have. And for this test, I used the 5 months male liver samples from Biswa Lab, and that gave us like 12 in total samples. And after the alignment, I tried one round of like transcript assembly to just get a sense about in terms of the final assembled transcript, how many we are getting, and if there is a big difference between the first pass and the second pass alignment. So here is the sort of like the component of the assembled transcript of those 12 samples. So this analysis is very cool. Some of the annotations still need to be updated, but this just shows a rough idea. So basically here I separate the assemble the transcript into four categories. The first one is the assembled transcript is only overlap with only the protein coding genes that are defined by RefSeq, and we may want to update this later to a more comprehensive annotation. And we also have the one which we call the protein coding T chimeric, meaning the example, the transcript overlap with both protein coding exon as well as extended to a T nearby, at the previously annotated like an intronic region. And also we have another category called the TE only. So those will be the assembled transcripts that do not overlap with the annotated protein coding genes, but only TE, and the other means that based on the current definition, it's in the like intergenic region. So if we just look at the number of genes we assembled, seems comparing the first pass alignment and the second pass alignment, the number looks roughly similar. There seems to be a slight increase in terms of the number of transcripts we are assembled after the second pass of alignment. For example, you can see for the first sample here, we got a few exon only category gene, and also around 30-ish more T only transcript. So then what I tried is, since here we have 12 samples, to generate a master sort of transcript file, I used two TACO to merge them. And here is the merged result of the first round of alignment and the second round of alignment. Here again, we see in general, we gain a little bit more assembled transcript by doing the second round of alignment. So everything here seems to be fine, but later on, I also found the second round of alignment also generates something a slightly complicated. For example, here I have some examples showing the transcript reassembled that can lead to some interesting observations. For example, here is a genome browser view, which the two tracks on the top, those are the known gene from either the ref gene or the gene-code annotation. And then we have the annotation of the transposable element here, and those will be the transcript we assembled using the RNA-seq. The first group is from the first round of alignment, the second is from the second, and some of the RNA-seq signal are showing at the bottom. So we can see here we got assembled transcript going on the minus strand. It seems to start from a line element. Here is slightly harder to see the RNA-seq signal, but if we zoom in, we see it's indeed started from here. We can see the assembled transcript match the RNA-seq signal pretty well. And this would be another example where it seems we get an assembled transcript overlap with an herb element. This is a very canonical sort of a herb element, and it's on the opposite strand. And we can see from this, we only got the assembled transcript with the second pass alignment, not the first. So this will be a case where I think the second round of alignment help. But also, this is another example, it's also an herb element, but goes on the positive strand. It's also only showed with the second pass alignment. But this will be an example where the second pass alignment generates something sort of unexpected. I don't know exactly how to go ahead with this. So we can see for the RNA-seq signal alone, it seems everything's on the positive strand. But when we look at the second round of alignment, looking at the assembled transcript, it seems the transcript got a flip, and we also got some splicing site within. And that's something actually what I want to ask you, whether you have experience with this and what would be the best way to go from here.
This is a very interesting result.
Yeah, so have you guys tried the second pass alignment?
I should really bring Shu Hua into the discussion, uh-huh. And she's not here right now, yeah. I don't think in HERS pipeline and the second pass, a lot I was involved. I'm wondering, like, the most of those, so like the problem might located on like the highly replicated region, may be associated uh-huh. with multiple alignment parameters.
Uh-huh.
Like you show this screen, that's a, I assume that's a probably satellites.
Yeah. So yes. Yeah. The thing I don't fully. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but so to generate the new splicing junction, I did require to have at least three uniquely aligned with. Maybe I could try to increase that.
When you see it here, and I think from visualization purpose, what we show, they are all uniquely aligned.
Mm-hmm.
So all the multiple aligned rays will be directly removed. That's why probably in your previous slides 11
mm-hmm.
or the 10, you cannot see like the signals actually, you know, along with all the axons.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so they do have some uniquely aligned.
Mm-hmm.
But this is still like, you know, still hard to say, I would say. Like maybe there's a lot of multiple aligned rays biased during your calculation.
Mm-hmm.
This is hard, you know, the hard things to determine the multiple alignment versus unique alignment.
Mm-hmm.
I think I asked Shuha before, and her answers is based on like the how many, like the multiple alignment heats you allowed in the alignment step.
Mm-hmm.
The string tie will automatically, you know, divided that number and get a certain score.
Yeah.
So the more like the multiple alignment heats you allowed, the lower effect will be bring in by this multiple alignment reads.
Mm-hmm.
If you twist that a little bit, I'm wondering you probably can see something different.
I see, okay.
Yeah, and among all those, like the transcripts, I think the probably the slide 9, that's the best candidates. That's really good. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But this one can be identified in like the both alignments, right?
Ah, yes, that's true.
I see.
Yeah, it seems the second pass alignment improved something, but also brings something slightly complicated. So I'm not entirely sure whether I should do that to the target data.
I mean, I'm wondering, could we do some simulation? Just like sometimes simulation is really powerful, and we know what is it in the sensitivity and the specificity. But this case, the TE is hard to simulate in some case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I only did it because based on what I read, people claim the second pass would help to detect the junction. And I was thinking since later on we would also might be interested in like learning the alternatives like a splicing event upon treatment. So that would be something good to have, but it seems slightly more complicated than what I was previously thought.
Yeah. Yeah, for those like the technical details, I'm thinking, and we definitely need to bring Shu Hua here.
Uh-huh.
And she's working on the de novo examples a long time, and I would like to hear her suggestion.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Yeah, but I really like this analysis. I think the at least from this example, what we've shown here, this is probably a non-coding gene, I assume, right?
Partially overlap with a non-coding gene here.
Yeah. So the official annotation that's come from gene code and.
So the first is ref gene, the second is gen code basic.
Yeah. I see.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like for example, if we get the most updated version, whether it would be have one that is this long, but at least based on the current thing we have, it doesn't look like so.
Yeah, there's also a couple like annotations available right now. I think one of them is called TE transcript. I don't know how that's generated. I need to read more details, but I remember it's there. And many of cases, when we do de novo example, we found some novel transcripts that cannot be identified by the gene code. It's actually have some record in the TE transcripts. So that's interesting. Yeah. You can find that track, I think, on the UCSC Genome Browser.
Oh, yeah. I would look for that. Yeah, I don't know that.
And one more thing is like that I also asked the same question to Shuhua before, but she didn't give me an answer to me. So could we involve the mappability of the certain sequence of the genome to improve the prediction?
The prediction of the assembly?
Yes.
For that, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like we dig a lot in the mappability of the genome before.
Uh-huh.
And we really see some regions are mappable, some regions are not mappable.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be trickier. And one thing is especially for your slides 12, because they are the satellites. In the real animals, actually, we have no idea how many the replicates, how many repeats of the replicates, the satellites, the 10 repeats existence here. So that's why you see very strong signals here, but we actually cannot detect it in the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar, will be aligned to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say for this and any T related annotation, let's probably just filter the simple repeats and also satellites.
Yeah, sure.
This is something we really have no idea to detect them.
Uh-huh. I see. Yeah.
No, but I really like this analysis. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, actually I already processed all the 5 months data with the tag saying init and with whatever or with those two parameters, but I didn't do the two round alignment for all of them.
I see. Yeah.
So I think if we want to start with some of the initial analysis, we can try with the first round of alignment.
Yeah, I mean, this is some kind of different strategy. And I think the one we do that in the sometimes, the Shuhua did merge all the BAM files together to generate the super BAM, increase sequencing depths to a crazy step, and find any possible one and then gradually reduce the numbers by increasing the cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
And another strategy is directly came from each library. Sometimes that's highly determined by the sequencing depths of the library itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have good science which one is better, since the super BAM strategy really costs a lot of resource.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering maybe we can set another meeting and discuss this topic.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Yeah, but I really like this result. Yeah, thank you so much. This is really nice.
Yeah. Thank you, Bo. Yeah, this is all I have.
Sure, no problem. This is really cool, yeah. Let's find another time to discuss it.
Yeah, it would be great to hear what Shuhua has, what she experienced with us.
Great. All right. So, Benpeng, do you have anything you want to share with us?
I have a very short presentation.
Cool.
Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, as Yanming requested, they want to have the risk count table for their 5 months blood and the 3 week liver data, and now actually we have some kind of enough sample for the adult blood and the waiting liver data for most of the labs. So here, I combine the three type of data set, adult liver, adult blood, and the waiting liver data to do the peak calling, to reduce the peak calling, and get then we could get the unit peak. And then based on unit peak, we could do some comparison analysis across the three type of data, such as the comparison between different lab, the comparison between the liver and blood, the comparison between different age. So here these two tables show the adult liver and adult blood sample we have now that passed the QC score. I also showed this previously. And in Ehler lab, only seven sample of the adult blood passed the QC. And also this table also the willing liver data sample we have now passed the QC score. And there are totally about 500 sample about this adult liver, adult blood, and 3 week liver data. So firstly, I combine all those data to do the peak calling, get the unit peak. Get the merged peak across all those sample, and we got about more than 400,000 the merged peak, and then filter the merged peak, we got about more than 200,000 unit peak, and then based on the byte file, we calculate the risk count table for the merged peak. After we got this risk count table, we again filter the peak with CPM greater than 1 in at least 10 sample. Then finally, we got more than 200,000 peak. And due to large number of sample, it took some time to finish this processing. I just got those risk count table result yesterday, and then I just do a quick PCA analysis to check the distribution and the quality of those data. Like these two PCA show here, the left and the right PCA are the same plot, but with different legend. The crossing is a adult blood sample, and the dot is the adult liver sample, and the triangle is the willing liver sample. Based on this plot, we can see a good separation between the blood and the liver data. But for the liver data, the adult liver and the willing liver data, they are mixed together. Meanwhile, actually, we also see some liver sample, adult liver sample, very close to the, blood sample, very close to the liver sample. And also, if I check this 3D PC, actually, we can see here, the crossing is the blood and the diamond is the willing liver, and dot is the willing is the adult liver. Actually, those blood sample very close to the liver are all come from the Bartholomew data, and those three and this one are Bartholomew control female, control male, and these two are the Bartholomew treatment data. Then I use IVR separately. IVR do the batch effect correction separately for the adult liver, adult blood, and the willing liver data with different key. And here are the PCA plot with different legend. Like show here, the left the crossing is adult blood. Dot is the dark liver and the triangle is the willing liver. We can see a good separation between the blood and the liver data. We still see the mixture between the adult liver and the willing liver. And for the blood data here, we see a cluster located here, and this cluster is the female, is the Bartholomew. PCA, like show here, still the crossing is blood, and the dot is the dark liver, the square is the willing liver. We see these four samples, all of them are the Bartholomew control female sample. And also, if we check those cluster, and all those clusters are from Bartholomew data. This is Bartholomew BP 18 milligram, and this is another Bartholomew treatment. And here we see the separation between the blood and the liver, but we don't see the good separation between the dark liver and the within liver. So I do a PCA port just for the dark liver and the within liver. And it seems we still see the mixture between the dark liver and the within liver. But for the within liver data, some kind of located on the right part. And here the right shows the female and the male. On the 3D PCA, actually the square is the within liver and the dot is the dark liver. We see some kind of separation. The adult liver located on the bottom and the within liver located on the top. And we also see some cluster like show here. All those samples came from the Bartholomew lab, and they cluster together. No matter this is for both the liver, adult liver and the within liver, they cluster together. And that's all I have.
Benpeng, do you have the mouse ID for the samples that in between the liver and blood? Did you use the updated, which metadata were you using?
I think I use the recent updated metadata you shared to me. Yes.
And yeah, could we see the 3D PCA and get the mice ID? Could you just...
Not the UUID, but this
no.
is...
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Could I see, could you also point to the, what about the, oh, sorry. Okay, I see.
Yes. Yes, and all of them are from Bartholomew data. And after correction, actually, we don't see the mixture, but we see here the Bartholomew control female located between the blood and the liver data.
So yeah, if you go back to previous PCA before correction,
mm-hmm.
and actually you have a four, like the purple X on the left side, right?
Mm-hmm.
One actually embedded in the top with a diamond.
This one? And
yeah, it's something's there.
Sure.
Do you have like the broader shot of the of those samples?
I don't have the broader shot.
Yeah, they are marked as blood. I mean, previously
yes.
we identify a sort of regions like the blood specific and the liver specific.
Mm-hmm.
And how they look like on the browser. And also long time ago, I think that we defined a so-called like a tissue score just by using this tissue specific, you know, the regions between
mm-hmm.
the liver and the blood. And we actually remove couple like the outliers at that time. I'm wondering like all those data, did they pass that step tab, you know, for testing?
I see.
Like when we see it's blood, are they a true blood? This
mm-hmm.
is my question number one. And if they are the true blood and how they are like the blood signatures comparing to the rest, if they sort of weak and more close to liver, and we may have to considering they are just outlier and remove them.
Sure.
And in this case, because there's at least four like the female blood, are so far away to the rest. And even you put the ROV correction, actually
mm-hmm.
just draw the rest to this side.
Yes, actually here is about the control female. Actually, we also see some control male.
Female,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, male, female.
What's Oh, control and the exposure. I see the orange.
Orange, yeah, this is the treatment, yeah.
Okay, orange cross, that's a treatment. Interesting. Yeah, I'm wondering if we don't remove the outlier, that will affect the ROV correction.
Sure, yes. Yeah, I will check the tissue score and the liver and the blood specific gene on the browser.
Sure. And one more thing, if you go back to your slides and talking about the first sample size, the slide number 2, I think the attack seek blood, we're facing difficulty on Ayler Labs data, right?
Yes.
And I think that for each group, they submit 6, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could we build a specific session, broader session, and just for those like 24 samples? And I think I would really like have to look.
Okay.
This is interesting. Let's discuss about this part later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's all I have.
Sure. All right, thank you so much. Okay, any comments, suggestions? Okay, I didn't hear anything. So I will assume there's no questions about the result. Benpeng present here. Okay, so yeah, if that's all, I think that's all we have based on our agenda. And any other specific topics we want to bring here, and any questions, comments? Come on, I see all the people muted. Well, nothing. Okay, so if there's nothing we want to discuss here anymore, and I would say that's the end of today's meeting. So thank you so much, everyone, and let's meet 2 weeks later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.